This morning we have Jim Thompson, who's going to tell us about harnessing the tides and sighting and monitoring a new technology, which is exciting stuff. He's raised on the coast of Maine and worked in the sailing industry there prior to beginning a career in physical oceanography. But I guess you know all about wind and sailing. After completing a PhD in MIT's joint program with the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, he joined the University of Washington's Applied Physics Lab in 2006. He's also an assistant professor in the Environmental Fluids Mechanics Group of a Civil Environmental Engineering Department, and he studies waves and currents in the coastal ocean with emphasis on field measurements and physical processes. So, Jim.
How's the mic? Good? Great. So thanks for the introduction. As you can see in the title, Harnessing the Tides, Getting Energy or Power from the Tides. It's an old idea, but there's a lot of modern activity on this now. And so I'd like to try to give you a little bit of an overview of what's going on worldwide on tidal power, and then talk in detail about work that's going on here at UW and work that is going on just in our region, and some of the pending projects and some of the ongoing research there. So just want to start out and give you very much the big picture here. We're not talking about tidal barrages. That's an old idea. And 100 years ago, when people were talking about generating power from the tides, they were talking about something like this picture that's on the left here. And that's a tidal barrage that is operational in France right now. And the idea is very simple. You trap the high tide. So water comes into a bay and the flooding tide. And at high tide, you close gates. And you've got a whole bunch of water at a higher elevation. The natural tide runs out, and then you've got a big difference top to bottom. You've got a big pressure head going from high tide to low tide. And then you can just run a traditional hydropower dam. Then it's no different than the dams in the Columbia River, right? You're just going from high to low. That is incredibly expensive to build and has a very high environmental impact. You basically kill an estuary to do that. So that's an old idea that's not really being put forward anymore, at least not in this country. There is a new project like this announced in South Korea that is going forward and just got a big boost of private funding. So that's not entirely a dead idea, but it's certainly not what we're talking about here, and not the projects that are active in the U.S. So what we're talking about here is what we call hydrokinetic, so water that is moving, hydrokinetic. And that's shown in this graphic on the right here, and the idea is basically an underwater windmill. So many of you are familiar with windmills that are now starting to come online across our grid, and they look something like the large one here. Some of the biggest ones now that are a few megawatts are enormous. The blades are 120 meters. Some of the blades are as long as a 747 wing, and indeed a lot of the materials technology is about the same to make an airplane wing as to make a wind turbine blade. Well, as you can see here in the image, the hydrokinetic turbine, or one example of one shown at the, down in the lower portion here beneath the water's surface, it's a lot smaller. Why is it a lot smaller? It's because the density of water is so much greater than the density of air. The density of seawater is about 800 times that of air. So to get the same power, you need about 1/800th the swept area that you're getting power out of. So that's why the scale is so disparate here. Each of these would be about a 1 megawatt device, but the hydrokinetic device is much smaller, and you can see it's submerged. And that's the graphic also points out another aspect of the new approaches to tidal power, which is to have everything submerged. So we avoid a lot of the not in my backyard kind of reaction to renewable energy by having everything submerged. Now that doesn't mean it's completely benign. There may be additional impacts, but they're not ones of sight, at least. So these are kind of the old and new ideas, and these hydrokinetic ideas are what's going on right now and what we're working on. So just to give you more of an idea of what these things look like, I'm going to show you some projects that are going on around the world and what those devices look like. So starting at the upper left there, that turbine is a Verdant Power turbine. That's the company that makes it. And it's been deployed in the East River of New York. If any of you are familiar with New York, that's Hell's Gate. And very strong tides run through the river there. It's still salt water. It's connected to the ocean. And they have had off and on several of these turbines, up to six in the water, and they've been powering a nearby grocery store. And those turbines are about 5 meters in diameter. So they may look a little small in the picture, but maybe if you squint, you can see some people in the picture there. They're still pretty big. And they're a three-bladed turbine, looks a lot like a windmill. So that's that blue turbine upper left there. So that's the only active project in the U.S. right now. Other projects around the world going clockwise now, the upper right is a Clean Current. That's the name of that company. And that's been deployed right in our backyard in Race Rocks, British Columbia. And that's a neat application. There's a marine reserve at Race Rocks, and this turbine has replaced the diesel generator that used to run the outpost at the marine reserve. That's a much different looking device, although it still has some similarities, but it's shrouded, and then inside that shroud are the turbine blades, and they have about 8 or 10 blades as opposed to 3. But the idea is pretty similar. The water flows past these blades, they generate lift, and everything turns. And it's the turning that runs the generator, just like a steam turbine or at that point, just like a traditional hydropower turbine. So it's the rotational motion that's actually generating power with magnets. Then continuing to move clockwise here, bottom right here, this is the marine current turbine device, and that's been deployed in the Strangford Lock in the UK. You can't see the blades in this picture. This is the test foundation here, and the two turbine blades are right here underneath the water. You can see some of the turbulence by the motion past the blades. If I go back up one, that's actually this device, the device with the yellow pylon there. That's a graphic from Marine Current Turbines. So that gives you an idea what they look like. It's a two-bladed device. It's submerged right now, and the pylon is designed, I said there was nothing above the surface. Well, for testing, they've been doing this kind of deployment with something above the surface so they can raise everything out of the water and do maintenance and see how the system's doing. And then lastly here over bottom left, this is a company called Open Hydro, and they deploy this turbine that you see in white here at the European Marine Energy Center, also in the UK, and that's up in the Ornkey Islands of Scotland. And that turbine in white there is pretty similar to the Clean Current turbine. It has a shroud and it has several small blades, and so it turns within that shroud as the currents go by. So lots of different flavors, lots of different devices here, but the big picture is that these are all test devices. These are all in the prototype phase. So contrast this to wind power, where now you can order a 1 megawatt turbine from GE tomorrow. That's not where this technology is at right now. Everything's still very much in a testing phase, and each of these deployments has been, one, maybe a handful of turbines to test it out and see how things go. None of this is really anywhere near a commercial phase yet. So, it depends on who you ask, but you could say we're 10 to 20 years behind the wind industry. But all these devices have several things in common, and the number one being that they are they're flow-through devices. So the water is moving and moves through and turns the device based on lift on some kind of blade. Most of these are horizontal axis, that is, the water's flowing and the rotational motion is on that axis. There are a few vertical axis out there, but that's not very common. And they're all on the scale of several meters, so 5 to 10 meter diameter is kind of the size of these things. So quite big compared to us, but still very small compared to wind turbines. Now, when I say these are flow-through devices, I want to emphasize some of the fluid mechanics here, that none of these devices are in a constriction. So conventional hydropower dams, those turbines are in a constriction. The water has nowhere else to go. So there's very high efficiency in those turbines. There's also a lot of dangerous fluid mechanics in those turbines, and we've seen that problem over the last 50 years with salmon and with fish trying to interact with those turbines. In these cases, this is somewhat more benign because these aren't being put in constrictions. And so if you analyze the fluid flow around them, the streamlines, most of them go around the turbine. So the water is not constricted to necessarily go through the turbine. What we find is that the fluid velocity is actually the slowest right at the turbine and faster everywhere around. So two different ways to look at that. One is that these aren't very efficient. The other is that they're more benign environmentally because fish and material is able to go around the turbine. It's not necessarily pulled through the turbine because the turbine is actually the slowest point in the whole thing. The turbines are just placed in the flow and rotate because of the flow, but they're actually going slower. They also, because the water is so dense, are rotating very slow. And so these are about 10 to 20 revolutions per minute. Compare that to when you're pedaling your bicycle, that's 80 revolutions per minute. So pretty slow, and that's in order to avoid cavitation. And so the best to think of these devices as big, slow, sort of lumbering turbines that have a lot of torque, and that's where they get their power, but they're not actually moving very fast. Okay, so that's an overview of what's going on right now in hydrokinetic tidal power. Now what about what's happening right here in Puget Sound? Well, I already mentioned up at the upper left in Race Rocks, that's a turbine that has been installed and has replaced a diesel generator at that marine reserve. So that's in Canadian waters, and they've, I would say they've been a little bit faster to get going, in part because they have a different permitting process. Now, there are two projects that I'm showing here that are pending in our local waters here in Puget Sound. Both of these are proposed or planned projects, and they're in the permitting stage right now. So these would be in the water in the next several years if the permitting process comes to a successful conclusion. It may not. So the first one here is the blue outline here is a project in Admiralty Inlet. So in this shot from Google Earth, hopefully you guys can recognize Seattle's right here. And then the dark blue is Puget Sound. And up at the mouth of Puget Sound is a place called Admiralty Inlet. It's next to Port Townsend. It's between the Olympic Peninsula and Whidbey Island. And it's where basically all of the tides for Puget Sound come and go. So all of that water in the rest of Puget Sound that you to fill Puget Sound, make the tides come up and down Puget Sound, has to go through that constriction. So it's basically the strongest tides in the whole system. And that's why people are excited about trying this technology there. So the first one in Admiralty Inlet is a proposed pilot project by the Snohomish Public Utility District. So that's actually a power utility that has proposed to do this. It's still not at the commercial phase. They don't expect to actually sell much power out of this, but they'd like to try it and see how it goes, and then maybe 10 years from now put in more of these so that they eventually are generating commercial power that gets to our homes from it. So that is this Open Hydro brand, which I showed you in the previous slide. This is a slightly different deployment configuration, but it sits on the bottom on this tripod frame. And the idea is to deploy two of these for 5 to 10 years and see how they do. Eventually to make a lot of power and to actually have a big contribution to Seattle's power usage, you would need maybe 50 of these. You'd need quite a few. But there's actually a lot of room in Admiralty Inlet, so perhaps that's not a problem. But there's a lot of research that needs to be done before we get to that stage. So that's this project. Other projects outlined in the reddish-orange color there is a project by the U.S. Navy, and that's off the side of Marrowstone Island there. Also still nominally in Admiralty Inlet, very strong currents because of that constriction. And this is, in some ways, similar. It's a demonstration or a pilot, but it has a slightly different application. The U.S. Navy would like to power some of their shore facilities with these kind of renewable technologies. They want to do it for several reasons. One is that they have a big mandate from the new Secretary of the Navy to get off of oil and to have, this is an amazing new target that was just announced, 50% renewable power at all Navy shore facilities by 2020. It's really an impressive target. It'll far, far lead what we do in the rest of the country if it's successful. What they also want is strategic power. They don't want to be waiting on the next shipment of diesel or oil or whatever it is to power their base. So if they can generate power locally at marine bases or around the world, then that's a good thing for them tactically. And so that's where they like to demonstrate this device. And that device may be recognized from the previous slide. That's the Verdant turbine. So you can see a lot of these things are the same. There aren't that many devices out there that are really to the full-scale prototype stage yet. A lot of other ideas that are half the way there, a lot of things in people's garages too, but there are just a handful that are really ready to go to sea at a full-scale size. So that's what's going on in Puget Sound right now. Just go over some of the reasons that these things are being pursued. I touched on some of them, but let me list them off here. The big one is state legislation, I-937, and that is a renewable energy target for our state in which conventional hydropower doesn't count. So we have some big targets to hit on renewables, and the conventional hydropower doesn't count. It's got to come from wind, solar, geothermal, or tidal power. And one of the problems we have in Seattle is transmission, that a lot of the good solar is to the east, a lot of the good wind is to the east, and once you make that power, you've got to get it over the Cascades here to Seattle. Those transmission lines are mostly at capacity, and it's very expensive to build new ones. So one of the things that's compelling about tidal for Puget Sound is that we have a large resource right where we have a large load base. Some of the advantages of tidal energy, that's very predictable. So this little cartoon that's running around here is showing you more or less how the tides are formed. And the tides are formed by gravitational imbalance with the moon and with the sun. The sun's also very important. The sun's further away, but much more massive. The extra trick to all this, if you want to sit down and draw all the force vectors and make this work, is that the whole system is moving. So there's also the centripetal acceleration. And what it means is that there is a bulge of water in line with the moon and also in line directly opposing the moon from that centripetal acceleration. And that's also happening with the sun. And so we get tides when always with the moon, and we also get strong tides when the moon and the sun line up. And that's called the spring tide, even though it happens year-round. And we get weak tides when the sun and the moon are at right angles to each other, and that's called a neap tide. And those happen twice a month. So the point of this cartoon is that this geometry is really well known. In fact, we can make a prediction for what the tide's going to be in Seattle 100 years from now, and I would bet it's within 5%. I would bet a lot of money. It's very, very well known how this whole system works, and so we have great predictable resource. Compare that with wind, where you kind of know your power generation maybe 3 days out, maybe 5 days out. But those forecast models, even though they're very complex, are still limited to, you know, a few days. And it's very helpful for smart gridding to know when you're going to have power, right? Other points, similar to, you know, many renewables, no CO2 emissions, no visual impact because they're submerged. And then in this case, they're close to the load center. So this is why you might want to pursue tidal power. But there's a lot of research to be done, a lot of things to consider. The first is that in many of these constrictions, there is a lot of existing use. So the graphic up at the top there shows the GPS logs of 1 day of ship traffic in Admiralty Inlet. The yellow lines are the ferry crossing from Keystone to Port Townsend, and the red lines are container ships coming and going from Seattle. So that piece of water has a lot of use already. Now, most of that's at the surface, so maybe there's not a conflict with something that's 200 feet down at the bottom, but still, there's a lot of use there already. Other areas, there may be fishing. There's no active fishing in Admiralty Inlet, there may be fishing in other areas that you consider, and there may be other existing uses. So that's something we always have to consider. And then the biggie is, what are the potential environmental effects? Lots of different concerns there, and that's a lot of the research that's going on at UW, is to understand what are the environmental effects of a single turbine, and then if we can sort of get that well-constrained, then what are the environmental effects of a field of 50 turbines, and how does that scale? How do you do that before you build it? I think we've all learned there have been a lot of hard lessons in the last 50 years of conventional hydropower, and that we don't want to repeat those mistakes. One of the things which I'll highlight later that I think is a big deal in our area is the production of noise, of underwater noise. And sound propagates very well underwater. Sound's also very useful for marine mammals underwater. So we want to understand if we're going to change the acoustic environment by using these turbines. And then at the end of the day, what this has to come down to for a public utility to make use of it is the economics. How much power can you get for how much cost? The ocean's a pretty difficult place to keep things running and operating. It's very corrosive, and it's very difficult to do operations and maintenance. So, you know, if this isn't, even if the other two bullets are taken care of, if this isn't cost competitive, then it will eventually be abandoned. So those are some of the considerations. So to work on all of this, we have here at UW the Northwest National Marine Renewable Energy Center. That's a mouthful, but it encapsulates pretty nicely what we're doing, I think. And it's a partnership with OSU and with the University of Washington and then several other outside partners from industry and from government. And the point is that the OSU is working on wave energy and we're working on tidal energy, and there's quite a bit of overlap in between. At the end, I'll put up a website. If you're interested, you can find more about what's going on at the center. So here we've got four different areas we're working on, and I'm going to focus on my area because that's what I can speak to, but I'll give you a taste of some of the other things that are going on too. So we're looking at environmental effects. We're looking at site characterization and instrumentation. That's the in-field stuff that I'm doing, and that is in collaboration with Brian Pelagi, professor of mechanical engineering. And then we have several students working on this, and then a bunch of technicians who are also helping with this. So it takes a big team of people to make this go. And then there are other people working on array optimization, that idea of several turbines all put together, and then people working on materials and how to deal with a corrosive environment there. So on bullet two there, to do our work, we use a research vessel, the Jack Robertson, which is owned and operated here at UW. It's 60 feet long and is really well suited to work in Puget Sound. Has an A-frame on the back that's useful for our scientific gear and things. And then we use a tripod that's shown in the right here. And this tripod weighs about 900 pounds and it's covered in various pieces of instrumentation. And we leave that on the seafloor for 3 months at a time, completely untethered, standalone, recording data. And then we recover it, offload the data, put in new batteries, etc., calibrate everything, and then put it back down. So sort of two different approaches here. One, with the tripod, we're getting time series data. We're getting a long baseline of data at a site. And then with the ship, we're using the ship to get the tripod back and forth, but we're also using the ship to do spatial surveys, which are very short in duration. They only last a few days, but then we can see spatial patterns throughout the region. So the big thing that we're measuring when we go out is the velocity, because that tells you how much power that is, and that gets back to that question of what's the cost-benefit of doing this. So this is just a little snippet of data. We now have about 200 days of data at the site up in Admiralty Inlet, but this is just a little snippet of 2 days. And the x-axis is days, so just 1 and then 2 days, and then the y-axis is the vertical, going from the very seabed at the bottom up to the surface at the top into meters. So this is about 200 feet of water, about 60, 65 meters or so, a little less. And the color scale is the velocity in meters per second. So do a quick conversion for you. It's about double to get to knots. So the velocity here peaks at about 2.5 meters per second. That's about 5 knots or about 6 miles per hour. Doesn't sound very fast, but for water, that's actually very fast. And it's certainly at least 3 times faster than a very fit human can swim. So it's fast enough to be dangerous. How's that? So here you can see the tides coming and going. The red are the very strong velocities. So as you expect, we get 2 floods and 2 ebbs per day. So you can sort of see 4 bursts of color in a single day here. And then again, 4 bursts of color. So that's a flood, an ebb, a flood, an ebb. Or the tide coming in, the tide going out, tide coming in, tide going out. And then also we see the blue. That's periods of very small velocity. That's the slack water in between tides. And so that's time when you wouldn't be generating power. Okay, so I said this is how you get the power. This is the only equation I'll show. But it's an important one. It says that the power density at a site is 1/2 times the density of the water, so that's about 1,000 kilograms per meter squared, times the velocity cubed. That's very important, because if you have a little bit more velocity, you have a lot more power. So that means that it's worthwhile to go look around and see where's the best velocity of these different sites. And a site that doesn't have... that has just a little more, maybe actually very economically compelling to go a little further. The other thing about these devices is that you see the light blue there, that's 1 meter per second. That's about where these devices cut in. So many of you have driven over the Cascades and out into eastern Washington, you've seen windmills that aren't moving, even though it's a little windy out, right? Well, those all have a cut-in speed. They have a speed at which there's a minimum lift at which they'll start to spin and start to generate power. Well, for a tidal energy device, it's about 1 meter per second. So all the blue shading here, no power is being generated. It's the red time and the warm colors that when there's a lot of power. Okay, so that's the big measurement we make to determine how much power is there. The other thing we do, though, is try to quantify the turbulence. And I won't go into this in detail, but the upper panel shows a really detailed bit of an ebb and a flood in velocity, just like we were looking before. And then down here, this is a metric for how much turbulence there is in the water. And the red colors are high turbulence. It's a log scale, so big variations in turbulence here. And you notice that turbulence is increased when velocity is really fast. It's also increased at the bottom. It's because the bottom's rough, and there's all this friction with the bottom, and there's a boundary layer there, and so there's a lot of turbulence there. Well, you might remember that's also where these devices are going to get sighted, right? They sit on the seabed. So there's some extra research to be done there to figure out, well, where do you get out of the turbulence enough that it's useful for the turbine? We also look at the direction of the tides. And this is important because at some places, the tides don't just come and go straight and back. There can be changes in the geometry that make the tide a little bit different coming or going. So we evaluate that. Well, one of the big things that's coming out is assessing the boundary layers here. So you may have noticed in the previous plot that the flow is very reduced near the bottom. That can be shown schematically in this figure at left here.
where going from seabed up to the sea surface on the y-axis, the velocity is smaller near the bottom on this axis, and getting larger as we go up in the water. So you can imagine that this turbine here that's higher up would generate a lot more power than this turbine that's lower down. But there may be reasons not to go with that higher turbine. It may be that there's ship traffic that needs some clearance level, or it may be that that gets the turbine up into the photic zone where there's a lot of biological productivity, where there's a lot of, there are animals feeding, there are different, you know, things that you may not want to interact with. So it may make more sense to be down lower. It also may be very expensive to get up that high. The engineering to put something, in that drawing that's 30 meters, the engineering to put something 30 meters up and have that much load on it and keep it from tipping over, that's really non-trivial. That's very expensive engineering. So there's a trade-off there. More power if you go higher, but many compelling reasons to stay lower. There's also a problem with this analysis that that this line here that's been drawn is sort of, I'd say it's cute. It doesn't really represent reality very well. On an average, it does. That's the average profile coming into the boundary layer. But instantaneously, if we look at the red line, that's an instantaneous profile, one observation of real data. Doesn't really look very much like that nice, smooth profile, does it? So we need better metrics and better ways to describe these boundary layers so that when we give input parameters to the device designers, they have something that is much more realistic, and they don't just expect that, you know, if I move up a meter, it gets so much more or so much less, right? So that's a lot of what we do in terms of the velocity measurements. The other thing, which I touched on before, that we're doing a lot of work measuring is the underwater noise. So if you're not familiar with the concept, there's a lot of noise underwater. If you go diving at Alki, for example, you can hear the water taxi coming and going. You can hear a lot of things underwater. Sound travels very well underwater. It travels about 5 times faster than it does in air, and there's not that much attenuation, at least at lower frequencies. So you can hear for a long ways, and sound is very important, as I said, for marine mammals. Orcas use it to echolocate, like a bat does, and they also use it to communicate. So we're trying to understand what is the existing acoustic environment at these sites, and then what may be the impact of putting in a spinning turbine, which is going to make noise, just like a ship makes noise, right? So here's an example of how we do these measurements. We put a hydrophone over the side, just like a microphone, just works underwater, and we record the response of that hydrophone, and we get various data sets, and here's two examples here where the raw data are the upper panels, and the red line is a very quiet period, and that's the raw data on the upper left. The blue line is a very loud period, so that's upper right, and those are the raw data. We then transform those data into a frequency spectrum, so we can look at their frequency content. What that really means is we're looking at pitch. So in this frequency spectrum, on the very far left here, those are the lower tones, lower pitch, and up here on the right, these are the higher tones, higher pitch. So this is in hertz here, and that's 20 kilohertz is about the limit of human hearing. But marine mammals use frequencies much, much higher than that, especially for echolocating. So you can see that what your eye would notice in the top in the raw data is that, boy, there's quite a bit more going on in the blue line. But when we go to look at it in frequency, we say, yes, there is a lot more going on in the blue line. It's much louder. And in particular, it's much louder right here at these tones where that peak is. So that allows us to analyze what the pitch is of those signals, and then we can make some quantitative estimates of how far that'll propagate and what may have caused it. Here's some examples. If I take those lines I just showed you and stack them all up and give them a color, then we end up with this compressed spectrogram, we call it. And what it's showing is a day's worth of noise data at Admiralty Inlet. So we start out at midnight over here at the left, walk through to noon, and then back to midnight. And the y-axis is frequency going from low tones down here up to high pitches at the top, and the color is how much sound there is. And what we see is a lot of variations, but the big things are the ferry crossings, which happen regularly throughout the daylight hours, and you can see in these bands, and these line up perfectly with the ferry schedule, or actually the ferry's not always the schedule, they line up perfectly with the GPS logs of the ferry.
And then there's other ship traffic, like this big container ship coming through here, and those also have a GPS log through the vessel traffic system that's in Seattle, and so we can cross-check those too.
And we can see that when these big ships come through, they generate a lot of noise. So
the first point is that for this site at least, shipping is probably the biggest thing that's making noise in the area, and it's really having a dramatic effect on the level of ambient noise. So if you go out and measure when there's not a ship there, you come up with a very low baseline noise level. But if you measure when they're shipping there, you have a very different baseline noise level. You also notice that these big bands of what we would call broad spectrum noise that show up, and those are related to the tides themselves. Because the tides flowing very fast over a rocky bottom, they make a lot of noise. So we can take all those complicated plots and boil them down to something much simpler, which is just a cumulative distribution function of the noise. And so that's shown here with the sound pressure level. This is in dBs. Is shown at the bottom, and then the y-axis is the percent of time that's observed. And we find that the blue line is all surveys, and then 120 dB right here. That's about where you hit the 50% line. So you want to say, well, about half the time at this site, it's more than 120 dB, about half the time it's less than. If anyone's used to airside acoustics, subtract 60 to get about an equivalent air number. So it can get quite loud there is the point. I mean, getting up to sort of 145, 150 dB, that's very loud. The NOAA calls anything above 120 dB exceptional, and anything above 180 dB is considered harassment of a marine mammal. Interesting note that most ships are above 180 dB. There's an ongoing problem in Puget Sound. So this is how we kind of summarize all the noise we find. And then what I was saying about the tides is that base level of noise is really strongly tied to how strong the velocity is. So we're measuring velocity right at the same spot, all on that tripod, different instruments measuring this stuff. And if we look at the velocity, the blues are the floods and the reds are the ebbs, but they're pretty similar in size. As the tide comes and goes, when the tides are really strong here and here, then there's a really dramatic elevation in the noise. This is a tricky thing. It's the turbulence flowing over the bottom that's making a lot of noise, but there's also turbulence flowing past the hydrophone that's making noise. And that's just like when you're riding a bike and you hear the wind going past your ear. That's a turbulence coming past your ear. That's not real noise in the environment, right? That's noise that's because you're moving, but your friend standing on the side of the trail doesn't hear that noise. So this is an active area of research that master's student Chris Bassett's working on, is how to separate out what is the flow noise or the pseudo noise compared to what is truly natural turbulent noise. And it's something that hasn't received much attention in underwater acoustics. It's a very difficult problem, but I think for understanding tidal power sites, which are always going to have very strong velocities, we need to be doing this work so that we can make a really objective quantitative assessment of what is the noise already at this site, and then we start to consider what happens when you put a turbine there. What does that do to change the noise, right? So that's the next step in Christopher's research, is to simulate very briefly the noise that would be made by a turbine with literally an underwater speaker and an MP3 player, and see where that goes throughout Admiralty Inlet. And our initial projections would be that it goes about a kilometer before you can't hear it anymore, but it's actually going to be much less than the ship traffic is our expectation. I think, both a good thing and a bad thing. If the turbine's making some noise, then that's useful for marine mammals to be able to hear it and avoid it and say, oh, I don't want to go over there. But not so much noise as to be harassment, right? Yeah. Just like when you're walking across the street, you'd like to hear the bus coming, right? But not so loud as that it hurts your ears, right? So that's the work on the acoustics. Some of the other work we're doing is just to assess the water quality there. And plots here are temperature and salinity and dissolved oxygen. Dissolved oxygen being a very important topic in Puget Sound right now because of the hypoxia that's been happening in Hood Canal on sort of a interannual cycles. So we're trying to understand what is in the water right now at that site, again, to get a baseline, and also how much that site controls what happens in the rest of Puget Sound. Because remember I said all of the tides come through Admiralty Inlet. So if you change the nature of the water coming in or going out, what does that do to the rest of the sound, right? So we're doing chemistry and long-term sampling on site to understand what the water quality is. Another thing we're doing is looking for fish. And for that, we use an echo sounder. And this is a local company, Biosonics, that makes a scientific echo sounder. And that's suspended from the ship, and it sends a pulse of sound down, and it gets backscattered, it gets returns, just like a sonar, from various things in the water. And this is an image where we're driving along a track, and this is in the vertical, where we get a very strong return at the seabed, that's a red line. And then occasionally we see something in the middle of the water that may be a fish school. This data is very difficult to interpret and need simultaneous fish trawls and other data to really make this quantitative, but it does help us see what's in the water right now. And so this is ongoing. And this is also an area of new technology development, that to monitor these sites and understand what are the fish doing around these turbines, we need better acoustics, basically. It's very dark at 200 feet. So you can't just put an underwater video camera down there. Or you could, you could light it, but then you put a big light at 200 feet, which is probably going to alter the behavior of the species down there. So you see, there's definitely some more work to be done in just the technology of how to monitor these things. This is a very nice real-time monitoring technique, but you don't quite know what that bright green target was. There was something in the water, but, you know, was it a school of, you know, of smaller fish, or was it one big target? You know, what was it? So that's ongoing work. And then another thing we're doing is just looking at what is the benthic environment down there. What are the bottom characteristics? 200 feet is too deep for conventional compressed air diving, and the currents are too strong to have time to do technical diving. So we use a remotely operated vehicle, an ROV, to do this. And that's the little green guy shown up in the upper right there. And then pilot on the ship has basically a joystick control that's tethered to that, and we fly that around the seabed and collect video of what the seabed looks like. So for fun, I'm going to show you a quick little video here of that. This is the ROV leaving the deck of the Robertson, going into the water, and then I cut out the 6 minutes that it takes to get to the bottom, and then you can see it fly around the bottom. And while we watch this, just a few comments that we're learning about these sites is that they're mostly extremely rocky. And that makes sense because the currents are so fast that the bottom is scoured and there's no sediment. The currents are moving too fast for the sediment to lay down. So we find these cobbles that are sort of baseball to basketball size, or in some places we find that it's just scoured down to bedrock. There's just nothing there. We do see a few, you know, sponges, hermit crabs, things like that. So, you know, there is a habitat down there, but it's pretty basic, and there's not a lot of sediment moving around. So one of the earlier concerns with these hydrokinetic devices was, do they alter the sediment transport? Well, we think in an area like this, the answer is no. There is no sediment to alter. So if it looks like the driving's a little wonky, keep in mind that the currents are running at, you know, 5 or 6 knots. So that's way beyond the specification of this ROV, and we just do it anyway and do the best we can. You can see it's getting towed around a little bit here, but we're still getting some video. So, anyway, what you're seeing, and the reason that it's not looking, it's looking so cloudy, is those are air bubbles, cavitation coming past the thrusters in the ROV are trying as hard as they can, and they're cavitating. And now the bright light is a pencil in the arm of the ROV for scale. Okay, so there's more of this video posted on our website if you're interested. There's also a nice video of us lowering the tripod down to the bottom, and you can see the whole thing land, and then you can see our release mechanism trigger, and we leave the thing on the bottom. So what I've just given you an overview of is the work that I'm heavily involved with, and it's really all the field stuff to figure out what do these sites look like, what is the baseline at these sites, and then once there is a turbine, how do we monitor them? How do we monitor the level of turbulence? How do we monitor the biological activity? And how do we monitor the amount of noise that's produced and where that noise is going and what it's doing? So now I'll just highlight some of the work of others on these other areas and give you an idea of what's going on there. In the environmental effects area, one of the things that the center is looking at is what happens to the rest of Puget Sound if you take energy out from one point. Because it's a whole network. It's a whole system, right? So I'm going to walk you through this kind of complicated plot here, but on this side here, this is Puget Sound broken down into a 1D channel model. So complicated Puget Sound
collapse into just lines and dots that say you go from here to here to here to here to there. And the numerical experiment that you run is to take out some power at the upper end and see what the effect is downstream. Because all the forcing for the tides is happening up at Admiralty Inlet. And so, sort of an aside comment on how this works is that I think of a place like Puget Sound very much like an amphitheater. And you have forcing, you have a wave signal that starts at one place, and it propagates through the whole area, through the whole geometry. Where it gets to and how it gets there is really dependent on the geometry or on the acoustics. And just like a concert hall has good seats and bad seats, Puget Sound is sort of the same way. We have a point source that projects this wave out into the system, and sometimes it makes it around corners and constrictions, and sometimes it doesn't. So we end up with a very different tidal response in the South Sound than in the Hood Canal, than in the Whidbey Basin, and so forth. And so if many of you have spent any time out in Puget Sound, you notice that the tide tables are very localized. You have a very different tide, one place than you do 10 kilometers away, and that's all because of the geometry. So with this sensitivity to geometry, we suspect that if we do something in one spot, it's going to make a difference in another spot, especially if we're talking about the source. So the color scale on this side here is a result that says if you take out 145 megawatts of power from Admiralty Inlet, which is probably about the biggest plant that anyone, commercial plant that anyone would ever foresee for Admiralty, and this would be 20 years from now, 10, 20 years from now, if it were to ever happen, what is the effect of that? Now, 145 megawatts, that's a big chunk of our power, actually. I mean, that's at least a small coal-fired plant. It's to the level where it's a substantial contribution to our power usage. The result here says that the change in that height of the tide on the highest tides down in South Sound would be about 1.6 centimeters. So it actually is appreciable. If you take enough power out of Admiralty Inlet, you can change the height of the tide down the rest of the system. Now, that's not very much, 1.6 centimeters, but it is, it's finite. It's not a zero number, right? And for some of these areas where there are big tidal flats, big mud flats, where we're doing aquaculture, growing gooey ducks, growing shellfish, then 1.6 centimeters when the slope is 1 in 1,000, suddenly that's a whole bunch of space, right? So this is something that needs to be considered. What are the impacts very far field away from where you've done the work? So what I've been talking about to date is what happens right at the site. You change the turbulence, you make a lot of noise. But what about the rest of the system? Well, that's what this modeling is answering. Another thing we're working on is numerical modeling of the turbines themselves. And this is a result from some collaborators in mechanical engineering where they have a numerical model of the blade of a turbine. And in the upper part there, you can see the red and the blue are the lift on either side of a blade of the turbine. And so they have this very complicated computational model of what that looks like. And what they want to do is take all these things and add them all up and say, well, if I've got a turbine right here and a turbine right here, does the turbulence from this one affect the performance of the turbulence of this one? Or in some way, is the whole greater than the sum of the parts in terms of putting out a whole bunch of these? Do you make more turbulence if they're spread or if they're close or if they're not? And this is similar to a lot of work that's been done in the wind industry, figuring out how close you can put wind turbines. So that's work that's ongoing. Another area, the last area, is in materials. And here's just sort of a motivating picture where this is a clean current turbine that went in up in British Columbia as it was being deployed, and this is when it came out for maintenance 6 months later. So you can see that put something in the ocean, it grows a lot of stuff, it rusts, the ocean's a pretty harsh place. So the traditional approach to this is basically toxic paint. And anti-fouling paint that keeps things from growing. And we think that long-term, that's not a good way to go. And so we're looking at new materials that are composite materials that inhibit growth simply because of their structure, their makeup. So these are carbon fiber type materials that are being used in the aerospace industry that we're hoping to have some application here. So on our tripod that we put out for 3 months at a time, we're testing some samples. And they're just little sort of postage stamp size samples. Some of them are very conventional, and then some of them are more advanced. And now we just were out last week, and we added a few more that are getting higher and higher tech and seeing how they do when you just leave them out for a few months at a time. So that is
that's that other area. And then I think I'm just going to wrap up and show you. These are the two websites you can go to find more information. And happy to take questions. I don't have a good worldwide number, but the number for the U.S. is that there's about 9 gigawatts that's potentially recoverable. That is about 7 Seattles, so it's a fair bit of power. On the other hand, I think what your question's pointed out is how localized this is. There are only so many places where the tides are really strong. They're mostly on the coast of Maine and here in Washington and then up in Alaska. So I certainly don't think of this as any kind of silver bullet for our energy needs. I mean, it's part of a very, you know, the diverse portfolio of renewables, right? And in some regions, this makes a lot of sense. For us, I think it does because we're so close to, the power is so close to where you need it. In a lot of other regions, I mean, this is never going to do anything for the Southwest, for example. Worldwide, the other compelling places are South Korea, and they're pursuing this very aggressively. And in Europe, mostly around the UK, they're pursuing this pretty aggressively. And I'd say in both places, they're ahead of us, actually. Now, we're starting to catch up. There's starting to be federal funding to support this work now. But that that whole office in the Department of Energy only started 18 months ago. So, we have marine biologists that...
Repeat the question.
Oh, sorry. Do we have any marine biologists on the team? We don't on the original center team as it was funded, which I think is a really a glaring missing piece there. But we're bringing in some as we can find funding for it. So there's a new proposal session that just went out, and several people from the School of Aquatic Fishery Sciences joined in a proposal to look at this EchoSounder data where, you know, you see something and you want to know what it was and then be able to also assess its behavior. And that's certainly something that I don't have the background to do and say, well, it was swimming, you know, it was moving up in the water column, that means it must be blah blah blah, you know, that so that's expertise we need, but rather funding constrained. And so as, you know, the opportunities come up, we're trying to bring in those partners.
I'm not sure you're aware, you must be, the Washington State Department of Natural Resources has a habitat conservation plan that has been developing for several years now. How are you engaging into that process?
We meet with DNR and the rest of the state agencies once a month to review these ongoing projects and figure out where it all fits, basically. And so the lands where these would go, they're aquatic lands. I mean, they're 200 feet deep, but they are, these require leases by DNR to put anything on there. And actually, even the tripod that I have out right now, I've had out for a year, I have a lease for that, that says you're allowed to put this on state land. I mean, it's not any bigger than this table, but there's a process for doing that, and we're very engaged in that process. I would say, not so much, DNR has been, they've been great. You know, all of these different regulatory agencies have been very interested and mostly helpful, but they're in a hard spot where this stuff is so new that no one from the regulatory side knows quite what to do with it. It's a round peg in a square hole. No one knows how to fit it into the existing framework. And they say, well, we know how to license, you know, a new fishing grounds, or we know how to license a new pier, but what do we do with this? You know, so there's a lot of learning on all sides.
All right. Thanks very much.